Welcome to the Sunshine Economy, Buy and Borrow, Books and Libraries in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Imagine being 11 years old and having just read Huckleberry Finn. You live in a large urban area, and you've just spent several hours living in mid-19th century America, floating on the Mississippi River. It's a far cry from your city life. A book like that can change your life. It can open your mind and expand your horizons, even if you can't exactly articulate all of that when you're 11 years old. Maybe it happened to you. Maybe it wasn't Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, but some other book. That thinking back began a journey of discovery. Ray was in the fifth grade when he first read Huck Finn. He remembers it because he was late returning the book to the library. Even by the standards of the day, it was just a small fine, just a few nickels at best, but Ray didn't have it with him when he returned the book. Instead of forgiving Ray for his tardiness, the librarian demanded his library card. He handed it over the counter. The librarian then ripped it up, tore up the library card of fifth grader Ray. That library card, that passport to books, gone, destroyed over a small fine. Ray never set foot in a library again for more than a decade. Now, he told me that story with the passion and the disgust as if it happened just last week. But for the past 40 years, Raymond Santiago has worked in libraries in Chicago, in Tampa Bay, and in Miami-Dade County now as the director of public libraries. He found himself at the center of a much different financial fight over books this past summer. The Miami-Dade County Commission had threatened to close several branches, laying off more than 100 workers to make up for a hole in the library's budget. But at the final moment, the commission agreed to raid the library's financial reserves, putting off the tough decisions for a year. Since then, Santiago has convened a task force to come up with ideas for the library of the future. We spoke with Santiago, his counterpart from Monroe County, Public Library Director Norma Kula, and Kristen McLean, CEO and co-founder of the market research firm Bookigee. Raymond, what kind of future do libraries have in Miami-Dade County, considering the financial difficulties that the library system went through just this past summer to be able to meet its budget for this year?
We have a Blue Ribbon Task Force that's been called together by the mayor and a number of working groups that have been working for the last few weeks, meeting, looking at different aspects of library operations and library futures. And at some point, they'll all be brought together. And as we move forward into the next budget year, hopefully we'll have some strong proposals that the mayor will then propose in terms of what will reflect the needs, the ongoing needs of this community and the future needs of this community and what this community is willing to sustain in terms of their public library system.
Norma, you're responsible for libraries spread across the Keys in Florida. What are the needs of your stakeholders in the years ahead that you've identified?
Well, I think the needs of library stakeholders in almost any area of the country that you look at are basically the same. They want access to information, they want access to educational things, they want access to entertainment. The things that are different are not so much what we're providing, but the format in which we're providing them.
Kristen, do you agree? Is it the needs are generally the same, but it's how those needs are met that's changing and evolving quickly?
Yeah, I think that's true. We've seen in a lot of research, you know, when we ask people about what interests them and what drives them around books and content, what they're looking for hasn't really shifted, but the delivery of it has shifted quite a bit. And the question that I've been thinking about and looking for answers for is what does it mean to be a library in the digital age?
Raymond, how do you answer that question? What does it mean to be a library like Miami-Dade County's library system, 49 physical brick-and-mortar buildings?
Well, I think, you know, and I think you have to think of the libraries beyond those 49 buildings, because there's other things that I think we do and other libraries do that are just not tied to the physical buildings. You know, I think what Norman and Kristen mentioned in terms of the kinds of needs people are looking for, you know, it's all about learning. How do we deliver that learning? How do we, you know, what kinds of methods do we use for that learning? So it's an ever-defining role, but I think it's not a new role for libraries. Libraries have been redefining themselves since the beginning of libraries, going back to scrolls and you know, and clay tablets.
Yeah, but the difference between going from a clay tablet and a scroll on you know, parchment paper, going to the digital age, Kristen, is significantly different. It requires a significant amount of investment and reinvestment that was different from years of yore.
Well, I think that's true in one sense, in that the technology that we have today and just the proliferation of titles and information that's flowing around those networks is infinitely larger. But in terms of the value and access to information, I do think the fundamental questions about who controls information, where you have to go to get it, how you elevate your status through learning, all of those things are the same. We're just seeing them shift towards the tools that we have available to us today, and just the amount of traffic that we have.
Norma, how are you responding to, obviously the proliferation of information? It's the fire hose of information, but the library is the conduit, is maybe not a filter per se, but at least a funnel in the effort to make some sense of it.
Well, it is definitely, but I think a lot of it is patron-driven rather than librarian-driven. We're looking at the technology that the patrons bring in with them, that they're looking for us to show them how to use or how to work with them in using it. Or in some cases, they're showing us how they use something new.
What do you mean, like people coming in with smartphones and saying, how do you use my iPhone, that kind of thing?
Not so much how do I use it, but how do I, for instance, access your database of downloadable digital books?
Mm-hmm. And so, Raymond, to that regard, when we talk about the future of libraries, it is in a device. You've got a tablet here as we sit in our studio in Miami right next to you.
And I have an iPhone in my pocket, you know. So, yeah, I think it is. And I think to Norma's point, it is true that, you know, we do get lots of requests for people coming in asking us, how do you use this? Not only how to access, but how do you actually use this device? So, it the delivery methods are changing. And I think, we have a challenge in terms of keeping up with those. And I think Norma's point about, it is patron-driven. Obviously, we need to respond to them. I mean, ultimately, that's who we're serving. We don't create public libraries for librarians. They're created for the public, and they are a service. You know, we've gotten away from the concept of these being warehouses. They have to be active places where active learning goes on. And however we can help to facilitate that learning is really needs to be our goal.
Raymond Santiago is the director of public libraries at Miami-Dade County. Norma Kula is the director of public libraries in Monroe County. Kristen McLean is the CEO and founder of Bookigy. Kristen, do you hear an opportunity with these library directors when they're talking about technology and accessing the information and using the technology? Is there an opportunity for not only the library of the future, but the future of libraries? In other words, the funding for public libraries.
Well, yeah. So my background is in trade publishing, and I've worked very actively with bookstores and many other stakeholders in the publishing industry for many years. And I think everyone knows that consumer behavior is shifting right now, and a lot of online buying is happening. So the question that I think is really important to ask is, if buying is going online, how are people finding out about books? And how are people finding out about what they should be reading? And where do people come together in their communities to explore that? And for me, libraries is the natural inheritor of that.
So as we're seeing fewer and fewer retail outlets for bookstores that are existing for a profit, in other words, they got to sell a book for more than what it costs, if you go to a place where you can browse books for free, you're saying that potentially is the opportunity. But how do you translate that into a sustainable model, even a nonprofit model for a public library?
Well, I would defer to my library colleagues on that one, because I think that's a challenge. But I also think that it's really about advocacy and about being very clear about the importance of libraries and the importance of books in general in, what is a culture without books? I think it's a very important question.
Raymond, you've got your task force. How would you put that kind of challenge to your task force? We've got 6 million patrons that you served, your public library served in Miami-Dade County last year.
Well, we had about close to 7 million people come through our doors.
Not that you're looking to turn a profit from them, but you do have to have a sustainable model.
Well, I have to pay.
Yeah.
I have gas bills to pay, I have electric bills to pay, and
salaries and benefits.
Purchase to provide access to information. I think, Kristen is right. Part of it is advocacy. Part of it is seeing, what support a community is willing to give in terms of providing the services. It is a tough question, because you are balancing, especially when you're talking about any kind of public or cultural institution. Mm-hmm. How do you balance those needs with other needs in a community?
One of the things that Kristen talks about is still a physical space where people can experience books and interact with literature and interact with information, not necessarily on the screen. So, Norma, as you look at your library system strung out over, the Florida Keys, how do you match up that that desire that you and your stakeholders have for this physical space, but also, you know, the increased cost of continuing to sustain those physical spaces.
Well, the increased cost is always a problem, of course. But as Raymond said, the community support is so great. And that shows even in his own situation, where he had that problem this past summer. But look at the public response that brought out and the support that was shown by the people who were back in the libraries.
Well, not only was it a challenge this past summer for Director Santiago in Miami-Dade County, it is a challenge that you face currently and one that's going to be heated very, very soon because of the way that the budgetary process worked. You have no reserve fund right now for the libraries. You're facing, by some estimates, a $20 million hole in the next fiscal year.
Yes. Yeah. And we are. But I think it's always a challenge. I think it's, you know,
but I guess the degree of challenge is
much bigger than we've ever faced.
It's four times exponential what you had this past year.
Exactly. It's a much bigger challenge. And I think, you know, part of the work that we're going through right now is hopefully to help meet that challenge. But I think it's also important to look at and think about the library as place. You know, books are certainly important. Reading is certainly important. It's not the only thing that goes on in our facilities. It's not the only kinds of services that go on. And the library is place, and I think Norma would certainly agree with this, if you look at the kinds of activities that are going on in our libraries, in all of our public libraries throughout this country, there is book lending, there is book reading, there's access to electronic resources, there's cultural activities that are going on. There's all kinds of things that are going on in our libraries as they do become centers in communities, and particularly in a community like ours, where we don't have lots of public centers.
Should libraries be considering their senses of place? Yes, but should they also be places of commerce?
If I knew that I could make a book purchase and that a certain amount of my purchase would go to support my library, and that was possible to do online, I think that would be a very compelling thing for me personally. And it does beg the question down in the future about whether or not libraries have an opportunity to retail in some form to drive their own support. And I do think that would be a very compelling thing for people who want to support the library.
And it's going on. I think retail in the library, to some extent, has been there for a long time. You know, we've charged for lots of things. Mm-hmm. But more recently, you know, we've seen the surge of, you know, even bookstores in libraries. I think Orange County Public Library up in Orlando has a wonderful bookstore within their library confines.
Could we see that in Miami-Dade County?
Possibly.
Norma, could we see it in the Keys?
Very likely. We have a gift shop in one of our branches that is to this right now.
We're looking at all kinds of possibilities in terms of supplementary funding, all kinds of partnerships, you know, even concepts of, you know, pop-up libraries, libraries in a box.
Could those pop-up libraries then become replacements of the 49 brick-and-mortar libraries, some of which were threatened with closure this past year?
Sure. I mean, I think you have to look at all kinds of possibilities for delivering service. I think you have to look at a combination as we're looking at, and I think good library systems provide a combination of all of these points of access. And it really, because I think Kristen mentioned the word access before, it really is key. How do we provide access to the most number of people in the most convenient way to information and the kinds of services that we can provide?
I think the point about balancing the public good against all of the things that a government has to think about is really important. But boy, we would be so much poorer without our libraries.
Raymond, finally, as you look at that $20 million deficit and how to fill those holes, and your task force is looking at way to fill those holes, are taxes going to have to be on the table and part of the discussion?
I think everything's on the table. And you know, is it filling the hole? Is it not filling the hole? Is it expanding, you know, the fill to make it even bigger? I think what we're talking about at this point is really, you know, what is it that we need in this community? What are the possibilities? What are we thinking about in terms of a library of the future? What is that going to cost? How do we fund that? Everything is on the table.
Raymond Santiago is director of Miami-Dade County Public Library System. Norma Kula directs the Monroe County System. And Kristen McLean is CEO and co-founder of market research firm Bookigee. As Santiago works on his task force plan for libraries, there's no shortage of opinions about what a library should be.
A good bookstore and library should be fully stocked, operational, welcoming, all of the things that Barnes & Noble has been, and which I miss sorely now that the one in my area has closed.
That's Barbara Van Diepen of Hollywood. She wants a friendly place, plenty of inventory to choose from, something Linda Levenbook from Boynton Beach agrees with.
Start with a good selection of reading materials of different genres or within a genre. Good lighting, comfortable seating, and designated workspaces are also necessary.
Leslie King lives in Sunrise now, but she thinks her hometown library had it all.
I'm from Ohio, and they have the best libraries, period. Cleveland Public Library should be a model for the nation. They have activities for the entire family, and they support the community. They have writing programs. I took a course on screenwriting and fiction writing, a Zentangled art class. They have a theater inside that teaches acting classes and puts on plays. They do author visits, employment workshops, senior activities, home repair workshops. They also have a media lab for audio, video, and photography. It's just the best place to be as a library.
Three ideas on the future of libraries from three readers here in South Florida. Join that conversation. What would you like to see in the future for libraries? Be sure to tweet us at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Are you willing to pay more in taxes to help fill that financial hole that Miami-Dade County libraries face? At WLRN, use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Still to come on the program, the bookstores trying to create communities.
There are 14-year-olds out there, 15-year-olds out there who are reading, who are then letting their imagination go. And I believe they will come up with new ways of telling stories. Mm-hmm. And that will dictate the kinds of delivery systems that we then have.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Buy and borrow books and libraries in South Florida. The online discussion is right now at WLRN.org. I'm Tom Hudson. Borders, Crown, B. Dalton, Walden Books. Recognize those names. They've all gone bust. Selling books in today's market environment is awfully tough. The endless online inventories and pricing muscle enjoyed by Amazon.com has driven several big and countless little bookstores into bankruptcy, but there are survivors.
We've invested in the ambience of our stores. We've invested in the selection that we have.
That's Mitchell Kaplan when we spoke with him back in August. Most longtime readers in South Florida know of him. His Books and Bookstore has grown into four stores in South Florida, and he has licensed the concept and name for what will eventually be four more. He's also been one of the driving forces behind the just-wrapped-up Miami Book Fair International. It was only 2 years after opening his first store that Kaplan was instrumental in starting the book fair.
It's something that the city ought to take a huge amount of pride in, the fact that we have a book festival of the nature that we do have and of the reputation that we have this festival that has gone on for 30 years. It would not exist but for an audience. You can't put a book festival on and have no one come and continue that festival. So our festival has outlasted many others, like the New Yorkers Book Country, which was around for many, many years, is no longer around. The Boston Globe Book Festival is no longer around. So in this little place called Miami, we were able to kind of reinvent what a literary festival ought to be.
Kaplan spoke with WLRN's Kelly Mitchell before this year's fair kicked off. His business philosophy to compete is to create communities to draw in customers. But he's also responded to how technology has changed his customers. He's partnered with Kobo. That's an electronic book reader and app. Kobo is owned by a Japanese company and is marketed to work on other devices like iPads and Android devices. It's that kind of evolution Kaplan sees in the business that's driven, ultimately, he says, by the expression of authors and the acceptance of customers.
Even given all the changes in delivery systems with how we get our information, whether it's online, ebooks, physical books, there is some remarkable writing that is going on today and I think will continue to go on for the next 30 years. So what we hope to do is highlight those writers, whether they're writers for kids, writers for adults. Obviously, tastes will change. Nobody could have really imagined that graphic novels, for instance, would move into the mainstream the way that they have. And so there are 14-year-olds out there, 15-year-olds out there who are reading, who are then letting their imagination go. And I believe they will come up with new ways of telling stories. Mm-hmm. And that will dictate the kinds of delivery systems that we then have, I think.
There may be more ways than ever to borrow or buy or read books, and more books than ever to choose from, putting even more pressure on those neighborhood bookstores, like Books and Books and others, to find their customers at home and find them more and more from afar. Chloe Herring reports from Little Haiti.
On the 59th block of Northeast 2nd Avenue in Miami is a pink two-story shop among colorfully painted businesses. Florida Lottery posters encourage passersby to play here. Here is Libre Mapu. Inside, small red, blue, and white Haitian flags wave in a breeze from three ceiling fans overhead. But a young German couple is more interested in a painting owner Jean Mapu has for sale in the back.
He's the king of the castle.
Good morning, man.
Little Haiti's Libre Mapu is packed with books, newspapers, and postcards. Jammed into the store are 7,000 book titles in Creole, French, and English.
Hello. What's your name?
Clemens.
As the German shoppers can plainly see, this is more than just a bookstore. It's become a haven for Haitian artists, a place where they can gain some exposure.
It's not only here to sell books.
Haitian-American author Edwige Danticat says the tiny shop is a cultural center in this neighborhood.
It's also here to nurture a community, to bring people together, and to celebrate the arts, to celebrate writers and other creators.
But for all its cultural significance to this close-knit community, Libre Mapu is struggling.
Once in a blue moon, I can make a big sale. And some days, you know, almost nothing.
The top-selling item at Libre Mapu isn't a book or a painting. It's a homemade beverage similar to eggnog. Mapu sells it by the bottle. And if those sales dry up, Mapu says his store will probably close.
Losing the store is just like losing some part of myself.
And that's why some business leaders in this community are pinning their hopes on the store drawing more customers, like the German couple. In other words, the tourist trade.
This location, Libre Mapu, is iconic due to the fact that it's been in the area and it has been known as a cultural destination for people to come experience Haiti, its history, the people, and the culture.
Joanne Millard is director of the Northeast 2nd Avenue Partnership, a nonprofit committed to building business opportunities in Little Haiti.
In order to see more business, it's necessary to increase the awareness, the marketing, the cultural tourism.
The tourists do bring dollars with them, and we'd like to have some of those dollars stay in our community.
Shalera Stein and Jules is owner of the Little Haiti Thrift and Gift Store a few doors down from Libre Mapu on Northeast 2nd Avenue.
Vibrant. The businesses are coming back.
Northeast 2nd Avenue runs through the heart of Little Haiti's business community. It's often used as a shortcut for visitors looking to avoid traffic into Miami's hotspots. The challenge is to get those drivers to stop and shop.
As a community, we have to be able to offer what we have, the best that we have, to the people that come through Little Haiti.
San Angeles wants to make the streets of Little Haiti more welcoming to visitors by keeping them clean and decorating for the holidays. Bookstore owner Mapu has visions of a Caribbean book fair that would draw international visitors to Northeast 2nd Avenue.
Now, I want to create a big day in Little Haiti. That big day will be a literary day. That's my dream, you know, and I feel that we can realize it, and Northeast 2nd Avenue can become, you know, a tourist corridor.
I'm Chloe Herring in Miami.
Still to come on the Sunshine Economy, an author accepts electronic books, but not without reservation.
The business practices of Amazon and other ebook sellers have become very libertarian. So my philosophical problems and economic and political problems with ebook sales are still the same.
This is the Sunshine Economy, Buy and Borrow, Books and Libraries in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. A third of all books sold are not books at all, at least if you have a traditional definition of a book, of something with a spine you can crack, with pages you can ruffle, as a physical object. An industry association called the Book Industry Study Group finds about 30% of new books sold are in electronic form. A year and a half ago, it was just 20%, but the pace of that growth has slowed. When Native American author Sherman Alexie's book, War Dances, was published in 2009, he resisted publishing it in electronic form. As the book world continued embracing e-readers, apps, and devices, Alexie stood his ground against virtual books, as he did during his appearance that year on Comedy Central's The Colbert Report with Stephen Colbert.
You don't allow this book to be available on Kindle.
Not on any digital book format, no.
Why? What do you have against digital books? I mean, I'm with you. I mean, you can't burn a Kindle. I agree with you there.
But that's exactly one of the reasons why I'm worried about it. You as a libertarian, you as a small government person,
absolutely,
should be absolutely terrified of having a device that has everything you read, everything you listen to, all your contacts, all your correspondence on one easily pirated device. That's one of the reasons why I'm paranoid of that. I'm an Indian. I have plenty of reasons to be worried of the U.S. government.
I just want to say, they prefer to be called Native Americans.
That was back in 2009. Alexie's War Dances, along with his other books, are now available in electronic versions. He's written award-winning novels, poetry, and short story collections about Indian characters living on and off modern-day reservations. His protagonists often have a deep, obsessive love of books. Alexie spoke with WLRN's Sammy Mack about his change of heart on e-books and what he enjoys about the Miami Book Fair.
Well, it's like putting, you know, a bunch of geeky English professors in Bermuda shorts. I just like the notion of all that energy surrounding books.
How, for you, does something like the book fair change the way that we experience a story?
Books themselves are an individual experience, but the process of storytelling is about being in the group. So book festivals are actually, in a lot of ways, more old-fashioned than the books themselves. It's like sitting around a campfire listening to your favorite storytellers.
For a long time, you've had a reputation for kind of really dogging ebooks. In fact, I remember a funny rant that you gave as part of one of your talks at the book fair about how cruddy the e-reader experience was. And now you've got a lot of your catalog in digital format. What has changed?
The experience is still cruddy. What has changed for me is to reach a younger audience with my young adult work. Certainly, there's a lot more folks of younger generations reading electronically. That's part of it. But I still have the same issues. I still think the aesthetics haven't been fully explored or perfected, especially in terms of poetry. And the business practices of Amazon and other ebook sellers have become very libertarian. So my philosophical problems and economic and political problems with ebook sales are still the same. But it's also simply a business reality for me. This is the way the book world is turning, and to keep my job, I have to do it. It doesn't mean I'm necessarily happy about the business aspects of it. I'm not, but I'm excited about the artistic possibilities. If I'm going to do this, I want my ebooks to be way cool, and it's possible. People just aren't doing it in a mainstream way.
What do you think can make an ebook way cool?
Well, look at like the Edgar Allan Poe books, the enhanced ebooks on iBooks. They're amazing with video and readings and performances and bibliographies and amazing drawings. And so approaching literary fiction electronically in a multimedia way is very exciting. So that part I'm looking forward to. If I'm going to do it, I want to do it better than everybody else. If, you know, to sit around and complain about how unaesthetic and unpleasing the things are without trying to advance the art, I'd be a total jerk, and I'm only 65% jerk.
Well, what has that done for your audience?
You know, as I suspected, and as I suspect for other authors, we literary authors, we writers who work in the literary genre, we really don't sell a whole bunch electronically. The electronic book world is for other genres. So I have sold what I expected to, and I will keep selling actual physical books to the same sort of readers that I always have, and they'll give birth to the same kind of readers, and it'll be the same 250,000 people for the rest of my career.
I was reading your latest collection of short stories, Blasphemy, which has old and new stories in it. And I ran across a passage from the story Search Engine, where the main character, Corliss, is waiting in a bookstore. And I was wondering if you could read a passage from there.
Oh,
do you have your book with you?
I didn't. Nobody told me to bring a book.
Okay.
Hold on.
Wait, so you're actually bringing this up on your iPad right now?
Yeah, Blasphemy. Yep. I opened up Blasphemy, and now I'm looking through the table of contents for the search engine. There it is. You know, I've got about maybe 40 books in here. 10 of them are mine. I still do 99% of my reading with actual books.
Wait, before we go any further, who are the other 30?
Mostly trivia stuff and basketball-related stuff. Nonfiction and list reading is really good for me on ebooks. Work that has a lot of links to the internet. So if I'm reading a basketball history book, they have a lot of hypertext links to sites on the internet where they have more information. That kind of stuff works really well. But fiction, I still have a really hard time with. I still have the same sort of relationship with books. I need to write in them. I need to bend them. I need to throw them around. Ebooks don't do well for that.
No, they do not take throwing around as well as a paperback or a hardcover does.
There's no app yet for spilling coffee on your ebook, so I'm waiting for that. Oh, there we go. I got it. This is from a search engine. She walked through the bookstore that smelled of musty paper and moldy carpet. She scanned the shelves and read the names of authors printed on the spines of all the lovely, lovely books. She loved the smell of new books, sure, but she loved the smell of old books even more. She thought old books smelled like everybody who'd ever read them. Possibly that was a disgusting thought, and it certainly was a silly thought, but Corliss felt like old books were sentient beings that listened and remembered and passed judgment. She knew she needed to calm down. And to calm down, she needed to perform her usual bookstore ceremony. She found the books by her favorite authors: Whitman, Shapiro, Jordan, Turcott, Plath, Lurie, O'Hara, Hirshhorn, Alvarez, Brooke, Schreiber, Pavlok, Offit, Duncan, Moore, and reshelved them with their front covers facing outward. The other books led with their spines, but Corliss's favorites led with their chests, bellies, crotches, and faces. The casual reader wouldn't be able to resist those books now. Choose me, choose me. The browser would fall in love at first sight. Corliss, in love with poetry, opened Harlan Atwater's book and read one more sonnet.
I think anybody who loves books can connect with that.
My house smells like this. My office smells like this. So the smell of books and paper and ink is all around me all the time. I probably smell like that right now and don't even realize it.
When you go to the book fair, what are you looking for?
I meet readers to hear the stories. People tell you things. Very specific things about their relationship to your work and how one moment in your book can so echo something in their lives that your book becomes a part of them. And that symbiotic relationship is amazing and terrifying.
One of the audiences you've really connected with like that is the young adult audience. You mentioned earlier that your younger readers are part of why you're publishing ebooks, and many of your stories get taught in schools, including Flight and The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. How is writing for young adults different?
Well, I didn't write Flight for teens. It just worked out that way. I still don't think it's for teens, necessarily. It's a book that contains a 12-year-old girl genitally mutilating a cavalry soldier. I don't remember that in the last Harry Potter novel. I think the fact that Flight does get taught is great, but I never meant it to be that. And in writing True Diary, I didn't necessarily think of it that way either. Teens, young readers are going to sniff condescension right away. So I always go by the definition my editor has for young adult literature, that young adult literature is whatever a young adult happens to be reading at that moment.
Yeah, I mean, just talking about The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, it deals with some real, often rough subject matter: alcoholism, domestic violence, poverty, teenage boy sexual frustration. And they're subjects that you've tackled in other works. What does having a teenage protagonist allow you to do in that kind of story that you haven't done before?
I don't think I've talked about masturbation in my work as much as I did in True Diary. He mentions it three times. He doesn't do it, and that's enough to get it banned in some schools. But I think those sort of teenage obsessions are something I get to write about because I'm writing about a teen, but it's also fun.
Well, it's a New York Times bestseller. It's won a National Book Award. And like you mentioned, it's also been banned in a few places. What does that tell you?
That I wrote a great book. I wrote the book that needs to be read. You know, if you've got a book banned, it means Percival Everett, a writer, always says, you know, that if you're getting banned, then you're offending the right monsters.
Which monsters are those?
Repressive, conservative, religious freaks who want to control everybody's reading material, not just their children's.
Sherman Alexie, author, speaking with WLRN's Sammy Mack. Do you have privacy concerns if you use electronic readers, or do you prefer the old traditional book with the sound of a spine cracking and the sound of pages ruffling? Let us know at WLRN on Twitter. Use that hashtag Sunshine Economy and on our web blog right now at WLRN.org. Still to come on this program, trying to capture the boom of a best-selling book franchise.
I always look at Chicken Soup really as a phenomenon. No one could have predicted that. We certainly didn't predict that.
It's the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Buy and borrow books and libraries in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. See if you can recognize this series of books for the beach lover's soul. For the cat lover's soul, for the dental soul, for the grieving soul, for the horse lover's soul, for the horse lover's soul, too. The list goes on and on. Just a few of the more than 100 titles that have made up the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. From its beginning in 1993 until 2008, when the rights were sold, they were published by Health Communications, based in Deerfield Beach. Peter Vegso is the president and publisher of the company. He spoke with us about how business is these days.
Well, it's not booming like it used to with when we first started the Chicken Soup. But, you know, we're very entrenched in the addictions recovery world. And that world is, sadly to say, is actually a growing world at this point in time.
Do you think the success of Chicken Soup for the Soul could be had today, given the disbursement of the publishing world and the elimination of some of those traditional book retailers that were so key for Chicken Soup for the Soul's success back 15, 20 years ago?
Well, you know, it's that's a hard prediction to make. But as you know, even throughout the past 40 or 50 years, you know, probably other than Dummies, I can't really think of another trademark that really stood the test of time. And
Dummies is like wine for dummies, beer crafting for dummies, computer programming for dummies, that genre.
Right. They did a lot of dummies things. and that was a good sort of, if you look at a trademark name that people recognize, a brand name, Chicken Soup fit that. And I always look at Chicken Soup really as a phenomenon. No one could have predicted that. We certainly didn't predict that. It was one of those which sort of caught on relatively quickly, and word of mouth built quickly. And actually, it was word of mouth that actually made that whole thing happen and gave us many challenges. And clearly, then there was a different world in terms of independent bookstores and chains, and you know, and then the mass market people were into it. So that world has changed, as you know. Places like Borders, that chain has disappeared, and independents are specializing. They're not carrying nearly as much stock as they used to.
The barrier to entry into your business has been obliterated, essentially, with the digitalization of publishing. So how do you stay ahead of that?
Well, it's a good question, and one that doesn't have an easy answer. What we're doing is, again, we're focusing more in the addictions recovery area. And I think Obamacare, if it ever gets out there, might even help it in terms of, you know, outpatient and inpatient, it being treated as a regular, addictions being treated as a regular disease, and looking at insurance companies have to do parity. You have to treat it like any other disease. So we're putting more emphasis in that.
As you're aware, Peter, there's a significant controversy over the troubled rollout of healthcare.gov and, of course, questions about the ability to get uninsured Americans into the insurance pool.
Yes.
If healthcare.gov continues to move forward, and every indication is that it will, obviously, how big of a business opportunity could that be for the recovery, for the addiction, the inspirational business that that you've built?
Well, in terms of that particular industry, it's, I would give it the word booming right now, and will continue to boom for probably the next 5 to 10 years as all of this, you know, Obamacare, healthcare unravels. And, you know, more and more people are going to be given the opportunity to get into treatment, which they need, whether it be outpatient or inpatient. So that industry will grow. And as that industry grows, what we do will grow along with it in terms of people requiring information. Now, you know, we're doing more in the digital area ourselves. You know, we also offer CEUs to professionals online, although we haven't promoted that big time, but that's coming. And, you know, and our books will also be available. You know, we're looking at that, call it a slice of life, where people can actually access chapters from our books in an easy fashion, plus, you know, stories that we've, feature stories have been in our magazine over the years. So.
Interesting. So would you anticipate selling a recovery book chapter by chapter as opposed to the full publication?
Well, I haven't really come to that final conclusion, but that's on the table.
Hmm.
Yes. You know, it's the distribution, it's the promotion that is getting difficult in terms of, you know, how do you promote an author? How do you promote a book? You know, publicity, there's lots of publicity these days, but, you know, people's attention spans are that of a gnat, it seems. And so you have to be able to capitalize on it quickly and have a lot of repetition in a hurry. Keeping our fingers crossed that we can find a winner.
Does that mean maybe publishing fewer books and putting more emphasis behind those that that you do bring to market?
Well, it's, yeah, to some extent, we're already publishing fewer books. We used to publish probably in the, you know, 50 books a year, maybe. Now we're looking at maybe publishing 25 to 30 books a year. And, you know, being a little more selective and putting a little more energy and diversity. You know, the truth is authors have to put in greater efforts than they ever had to put in previously.
That's Peter Vegso, president and publisher of Health Communications in Deerfield Beach, the original publisher of the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. Vegso mentioned how publishers expect more from their authors these days, more from their authors even as there are fewer retail outlets. Still to come on this edition of The Sunshine Economy, buy and borrow books and libraries in South Florida, from bankrupt bookstores to creating new communities. This is The Sunshine Economy, buy and borrow, books and libraries in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. An ongoing discussion on the website at WLRN.org and via Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy, talking about where you learn of new books. We've got tweets here from around South Florida, reading in both paper or electronic format in terms of privacy concerns regarding electronic e-books. We have listeners here emailing that they listen to NPR, WLRN, to learn about new books before they go and hunt for them in bookstores and in libraries. A few months ago, a study of the book business acknowledged the dwindling number of brick-and-mortar bookstores and acknowledged the challenges over e-book pricing. But the report concluded, quote, "Otherwise, book consumers are finding new and efficient ways to get lost in the book," end quote. Daniel Sandler has found many of those readers in Miami getting lost in his crowd.
When I started Bookleggers Library in 2012, I was discouraged watching traditional bookstores closing up shop. I love books. I love looking through books. pulling one off the shelf, the smell and feel of the pages. I love what books bring us. Knowledge, adventure, surprise, laughter, and sometimes tears. So when I saw bookstores shutting their doors, I felt that I had to do something. So I started Bookleggers with a friend and a positive attitude. Bookleggers is a pop-up library, and we show up to a bar, cafe, gallery, museum, or public park and give away books, one to everyone in attendance. More are available to trade or for a small donation. After a few months of lugging countless crates of heavy books to weird and fun places around town, I realized the project wasn't about bookstores closing. It was about community. People of all ages and backgrounds show up to trade or take books or just have a laugh with other smart people and engaged people in Miami. Little boys and old ladies all delight in a party with a free book. I get great joy in every smile and every befuddled face asking me, is it really free? Bookleggers has shown me not just that there are engaged readers in South Florida, but that we are starved for smart community. A lot of people bemoan South Florida's lack of learning or intelligence, but I have seen a different side of our city. We don't need to worry about being literary. We are literary. We just need to be proud of that and support each other. And please, come take a book, preferably one of the heavy ones.
Nathaniel Sandler, founder of Bookleggers. You know, reading is an isolated practice. It's something you do for itself, something you do for yourself. But ultimately, it's also a practice that you enjoy as an entire community, something that the South Florida community enjoyed this past weekend. You know, there's an axiom that everyone has a novel inside of them. That may or may not be true. But the work that goes into finding an audience for that novel is what turns art into commerce. This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.